Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Chase Croft is at the control this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, this is the question that we'll be spending some time discussing. Does Iraq matter in the international war against terrorism? Now, the Bush administration has argued that it is vital for the United States to remain in Iraq militarily to battle al-Qaeda. Others argue that, in fact, before the United States invaded Iraq, al-Qaeda was not operating in that country. And they go on to say whether we stay or whether we leave, that the kind of threat posed by al-Qaeda, not specifically al-Qaeda in Iraq, but perhaps al-Qaeda elsewhere or groups that are sympathetic to al-Qaeda and share the same agenda, they would say it doesn't matter whether we stay or go, that threat will remain the same. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Iraq and perhaps in a larger sense terrorism with investigative journalist Paul Cruikshank. He's currently a fellow at the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. He's worked as an investigative journalist in London and reported on al-Qaeda and its European affiliates. He was part of a CNN reporting team that covered the July 7th, 2005 attacks in London and also helped make CNN's documentary In the Footsteps of Bin Laden. He's written about al-Qaeda and Islamist groups for a number of publications, including The New York Times, The Washington Post, The New Republic, Mother Jones, and Studies in Conflict and Terrorism, and has also provided on-air analysis to CNN, NBC, BBC, Fox, and Al Jazeera. He is the co-author, along with Peter Bergen, of an article on this very subject, on al-Qaeda in Iraq and the consequences of the American withdrawal of troops. He's written this for Mother Jones. You can, in fact, read it online at motherjones.com, and also look for an expanded version with greater detail coming up at the end of the week. It'll be there on the website at motherjones.com on Friday. So you can read the version that's there now. You can also then look later in the week for an expanded version. And here as we talk, questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Cruikshank, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, good to be with you, David.
I appreciate it. Just let me ask you some basic questions about al-Qaeda in Iraq, starting out with the question, how many al-Qaeda are there now in Iraq? Do we know?
Well, the U.S. military estimates that there are around 5,000 fighters with al-Qaeda in Iraq over there, maybe twice as many supporters. Now, that means that they're not the biggest insurgent group in Iraq. There are other Sunni insurgent groups which are larger, such as the Islamic Army of Iraq, and the overall Sunni insurgency might number around 30,000 fighters. So about 5,000 fighters within a 30,000-strong insurgency is the estimate that the U.S. military give.
And are these people, these fighters, are they Iraqis, or are they people who have come from outside of Iraq?
Well, senior U.S. intelligence officials say that about 90% of al-Qaeda Iraq's fighters are indeed Iraqi now. Hmm. That's a big change from the early years when they were mostly foreigners. There's still a lot of foreigners coming into the country, and many of them are becoming suicide bombers. But in terms of on-the-ground fighters, they're mostly Iraqi. Now, the leadership of al-Qaeda in Iraq is actually also sort of mostly foreign. Its leader at the moment is a guy called Abu Ayyab al-Masri, who is an Egyptian, close to al-Qaeda's number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri. So there's a sort of foreign leadership now, but there's an Iraqi foot soldier presence.
Do you, for those people who make the argument that were it not for the American invasion, there would not be a significant al-Qaeda presence in Iraq, do you think that that is true?
Well, you know, in our article, we argue that it was the U.S. invasion of Iraq which produced this threat. There were hardly any Iraqis involved with al-Qaeda before the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And now 90% of al-Qaeda in Iraq are Iraqi. Secretary of State at the time in 2003, Colin Powell, made the argument that there was a significant al-Qaeda presence within Iraq. He argued that that was through Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. That really was not borne out, and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi at the time was not very closely affiliated with al-Qaeda. He had around 30 Jordanians with him who were operating in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan, which was a no-fly area, not under the control of Saddam Hussein. And al-Qaeda as a whole is very in opposition to Saddam Hussein. Bin Laden, for example, hates Saddam Hussein with a vengeance. So there was really no evidence borne out that there was that cooperation between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Of course, now, unfortunately, the irony is that al-Qaeda is present in Iraq, that they have come there in significant numbers from around the world, but also they've managed to recruit a lot of Iraqis into the organization. So you've gone from a situation where there was no al-Qaeda there to a situation where this is al-Qaeda's main front, arguably. They've conducted 837 suicide bombing attacks since the U.S. invasion. Those have killed 10,000 Iraqis, and I'll just repeat that. Al-Qaeda suicide bombings have killed 10,000 Iraqis. If you think about 100,000 civilians dying overall, you can see that al-Qaeda are responsible for a very significant proportion of the bloodshed there, perhaps more than most people realize.
No, so setting aside the question, if one can, setting aside the question of how they got there and why they're there, you have to acknowledge the fact that they are part of the equation now and an extremely dangerous and disruptive force, so that now as we think about the future of Iraq, what's going to happen, what is the United States policy going to be, are we going to have any troops and how much, all of those kinds of questions, one simply now cannot ignore the presence of al-Qaeda.
Well, that's what we argue in this piece. As much as you can, you know, blame the Bush administration for going into Iraq under false pretenses, we're dealing with the situation that we have now. And the situation we have now is that the al-Qaeda network in Iraq is closely linked to the al-Qaeda network in Pakistan. The al-Qaeda network in Iraq is resilient. They've certainly suffered some setbacks in recent months, and perhaps we can talk about that later in the program. But they're still resilient. In the last 3 months since the U.S. surge reached full force in June, there have been 115 suicide attacks across Iraq. That's more than in 2003 and 2004 put together. The month of Ramadan, which has just finished, has seen a sort of intensified operations from al-Qaeda in Iraq. It's seen a new assassination campaign against Sunnis opposed to it. So this organization still has legs in Iraq, and it's the only terrorist organization in Iraq that has ambitions outside Iraq. The other insurgent groups don't really care about what happens outside Iraq, but al-Qaeda in Iraq has definite plans to launch out-of-area operations. Already in November 2005, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi directed operatives to attack three American hotels in Jordan, killing 60 people. Abu Ayyab al-Masri, the current leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, with close ties to the senior leadership of al-Qaeda in Pakistan, has said that he will not rest in his jihad until his organization blows up the White House. Now, that might be far off, and they might not at the moment have the capability to do that, but there's certainly a concern that if U.S. soldiers were to withdraw completely and precipitously, that they would be able to build up a certain amount of capabilities, and they certainly try and intensify their out-of-area operations.
Mm-hmm. Well, here now, this is indeed the argument that the Bush administration makes now for continuing military presence in Iraq. They have identified Iraq as perhaps being the most important front in a multiple front war against terror, and have made the argument that if the United States does not continue to keep military in Iraq to battle al-Qaeda there, to try to keep it in check, that indeed it will spread outward in the region, pose a threat to either Americans in the Middle East or our allies in the Middle East, or ultimately to the United States. So there is the question. Now, you have, in a sense, answered it by saying that the al-Qaeda in Iraq has stated this intention. They may not have the resources to do it now, but that doesn't mean that they wouldn't ever have the resources to do it. So does that in fact mean that however it is we got to this point, that the administration's assessment of the risk is correct?
Well, you know, I think that it is broadly correct, unfortunately, but I think there's a lot of hyperbole also in the Bush administration's presentation. You know, they claim that if U.S. troops were able to pull out of, you know, pull out of Iraq, that then al-Qaeda would take over the country. Well, you know, al-Qaeda are 5,000 fighters. They're not going to take over the whole of Iraq. So there's definitely hyperbole and exaggeration within the Bush administration presentation. But I think that they are accurate in saying that if U.S. troops precipitously withdraw from Iraq, you're going to have a real problem with al-Qaeda there, because if you take the pressure off the al-Qaeda organization, unfortunately, they're going to be strengthened. I mean, it's a pretty simple equation. Now, there are those who argue that actually it's the presence of American troops within Iraq that is the main driver towards al-Qaeda recruitment. And that if U.S. soldiers left the country, that al-Qaeda would actually be weakened because its main raison d'etre within the country would not be there anymore. The research that Peter Berg and I have done has suggested that maybe this is not the case, because rather than it being the U.S. presence in Iraq which is fueling recruitment for al-Qaeda there, it's actually the sectarian violence and specifically the Shia death squad violence against Sunnis which are driving recruits into the al-Qaeda fold within the country. Now, if U.S. troops withdraw very quickly, that sectarian violence will, most experts agree, only intensify to yet new levels. And that, unfortunately, could be an extra recruiting tool for al-Qaeda. Certainly, we've seen that it's in the parts of Iraq which you've had the most amount of sectarian violence, that al-Qaeda is strongest and they're doing the best. Those are the parts of central Iraq, where you have a mix of Sunni and Shia communities, the areas around Baghdad. So if U.S. troops withdraw, the civil war could flare up. And as I've been describing, this is somebody else's civil war, which could have direct national security implications for the United States.
Just to very quickly introduce again our guest, Paul Cruikshank. He's currently fellow at the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. He's worked as an investigative journalist in London, reporting on al-Qaeda and its European affiliates. He was part of a CNN reporting team that covered the terrorist attacks there in London in the summer of 2005. He's also written about al-Qaeda and Islamist groups for a number of publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Republic, and Mother Jones. And as I mentioned, he is now the co-author of a piece with Peter Bergen about al-Qaeda in Iraq that you can read now if you go to the Mother Jones website, motherjones.com. And then there will be at the end of the week an expanded version of this piece. Paul, is in the print edition of Mother Jones, is this article in there too, or is this just something that's online?
It's part of the cover story that Mother Jones have done for the November-December issue of the print magazine. What Mother Jones have done is that they're going from a debate about they're sort of going towards a debate about how do we responsibly withdraw from Iraq, asking some pretty tough questions in this new issue about what the potential fallout can be. Certainly, you know, there has been in the people who are opponents of the Bush administration a lot of anger about how the United States has got into this position. But what Mother Jones is doing in this new issue is starting to ask some very serious questions about what the next administration will have to do and some of the tough decisions that will have to have been taken by the next president.
All right. And so if people want to read that, they can go to the newsstand or wherever they buy magazines. They can look at the print edition. They can also read it online. And as I mentioned, there will be on Friday on the website an expanded version of this article that is kind of the basis for our conversation here that Paul Cruikshank has written with Peter Bergen. So questions are welcome. We have some folks here ready to go. Let's do that. Start talking with people who are listening, beginning with someone in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello. I wonder if you could tell me approximately how many people have committed suicide as bombers in Iraq since the invasion.
Yeah, well, that's an important question. I actually got hold of some statistics here, which I think you'll find interesting, that it's sort of 837 suicide bombing attacks within Iraq. Uh-huh. The March 2003 invasion of the country. Now, already this year alone, 2007, there have been 321 suicide bombing attacks. The 2007 is the worst year ever for suicide bombing attacks in Iraq. You can see how Al-Qaeda is sort of intensifying their violence. It's estimated that around 90% of suicide attacks are the work of Al-Qaeda's foreign fighters, people coming from outside the country, from Arab countries neighboring Iraq or from Europe or from elsewhere to the country to become what they term as martyrs. So those are the numbers.
I see. Very good. Thank you.
All right. We'll talk with next someone in Sandwich, Illinois, on our line 4. This is the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I like this. This is a pretty interesting topic because I study history a little bit. I've had history classes, that's what I'm trying to take up right now in school. I'm up here at Elgin Community College in the northern part of the state, and we're studying this part of the country, that part of the world. But I want to ask you, I honestly think it wouldn't have mattered one way or the other whether we'd have been there, 5 years ago or not. I think given the way this history is for thousands of years between all the tribal factions in that part of the world, that it's just a matter of time before they take one another over, kind of like they did in England, a couple hundred years ago. Is this true?
Sorry, I don't exactly understand the premise of your question.
Well, I was wondering whether, no matter who was in the Middle East, that it wouldn't have made any difference whether we were there or the British or anybody. Everybody seems to want to pin this on President Bush. I don't agree with him going in there either, but I think it wouldn't have mattered one way or the other. I'm just saying, how do you feel about tribal factions, and you're talking about insurgents, but all these tribes like the Kurdishes and the Shiites and the Muslims, they're all basically, if you look at history, take one another over. Am I not correct?
Well, if you look at Iraq at the time of the U.S. invasion in March 2003, it wasn't a nice place to live. There were UN sanctions. The population was living, a lot of people in poverty. There was a dictatorship, the brutal methods used by the Saddam Hussein regime to crush any dissent. It wasn't an ideal place to live. But what you did have in Iraq at that time, love it or loathe it, was stability. Now, the U.S. invasion of the country in March 2003 quickly unraveled that stability, and a lot of the tribal factions, the religious factions in the country, which has sort of been kept under tight control by the Saddam Hussein regime, then suddenly were in a position where they could start to put forward their interests. There was also a lot of criminality, looting, these sorts of things, disorder. The central government was very weak in the period after the U.S. invasion. A lot of mistakes were made by the coalition provisional authority. So the Middle East is a complicated place, and Iraq particularly, and the United States, I don't think, going in, realized quite what the cleavages were within society. Certainly, in the period since the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Iraq has become much less stable, and you have a really unprecedented amount of ethnic and sectarian violence within the country. And I think this is something very new. I mean, the Middle East has seen its fair share of problems in Lebanon, in other countries in recent times, but never on this scale.
Well, I'll get off. I'll just ask you one more question. What would your remedy to the situation be? And I'll get off. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, do you have, obviously this is the question, what given the circumstances we face now, what does the United States do? Do you feel as a reporter you wouldn't want to take directly on a question like that? I don't know.
Well, I think it is important to come up with options on these sorts of questions. I think that the best the United States really can hope for in the coming years is really to manage the sectarian violence within Iraq. And what I mean by that is to contain it, to stop it intensifying it, to stop it becoming much worse than it is. Because if the civil war does get worse within the country, that is going to have all sorts of unfortunate consequences, not the least of which will be that Al-Qaeda in Iraq will be strengthened by more people wanting to sort of come into its ranks. Also, a lot of the Sunni insurgent groups, which are currently in opposition to Al-Qaeda in Iraq, are sort of bickering with it, having fights with it in different parts of the country. If the civil war gets much worse within Iraq, are probably going to join forces again, perhaps with the Al-Qaeda lot within the country. Certainly, Osama bin Laden has, in the last days, come up with a new audio tape saying he wants unity within the ranks of the Sunni insurgency again. So I think the United States, a United States troop presence long term is going to be necessary in the country. Probably for a decade, you're going to have 30,000 troops at the very least in order to kind of contain Al-Qaeda in Iraq, to protect a U.S. embassy in Baghdad, to train the Iraqi army to better act for all its challenges within the country. And the real question is, what is the pace of the drawdown here? Do you pull troops out fast or do you pull troops out slow? I think, looking at the situation on the ground, there's a big argument for pulling out troops pretty slowly from Iraq. Right now there are 160,000 troops within the country. Next summer they're planning to have around 130,000 troops when the surge ends. That is not necessarily going to be sustainable for a long period of time. So, if you might be looking at halving that number of troops and keeping a lid on things within Iraq, because I don't think the United States can afford Iraq imploding.
All right, let's talk with someone else here in Champaign County, where we are, line two. Hello.
Yes, earlier you asserted that the sectarian violence was going to create the situation for Al-Qaeda to stay in Iraq. I would like to explore what your basis is for that. And I would also ask you to talk about, if you know anything about the suicide of the guy that was supposed to investigate. You remember the incident down in Basra with the SAS, the British Special Forces, being found in subterfuge, out of uniform, with plastic explosives. The fellow that was supposed to investigate that hung himself. He was British, speaking of suicides in Iraq. And it seems to me that the sectarian violence was actually fanned by the so-called occupation forces. I have not heard a good explanation for why this guy killed himself when he was supposed to investigate, and I'm not sure you're going to take this as anything but what quote-unquote conspiracy theory. But also, just the broader point, if you want to deflect that, is what do you base this idea on? It seems to me you pointed at the so-called success of the turning the Sunnis in the outlying areas, and now you can say that's because they were allowed to cleanse the Shia, which is probably true too. But 70% of Iraqis see a unitary state. They obviously have different perceptions of what that will be. But again, I'm coming from the point of view that the occupation is going to keep this festering, and that Al-Qaeda will not find a great environment in Iraq if the U.S. gets its hands out of there, and the British.
Well, let me. I mean, I don't specifically have any information to help you on the Basra case, but let me deal with the notion that sectarian conflict is Al Qaeda's best friend within Iraq. If you look at the country and you look at the parts of Iraq where you're still getting a significant amount of Al Qaeda activity, those parts of the country also happen to be the ones where there's the biggest amount of sectarian conflict. There's the most amount of Shia death squad activity. It's the areas where Sunnis feel most afraid, where they're turning to Al-Qaeda, not only for protection, but also for retribution against people who are killing their families, forcing from their homes, these sorts of things. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi wrote a very interesting letter to Al-Qaeda associates in Afghanistan in 2004.
I don't buy that as a legitimate. I think that might have been also.
Well, let me finish it.
Okay, please.
Abu Musab al-Zarqaeri.
I wanted to give that proviso.
Abu Musab al-Zarqawi sent a letter to Afghanistan in 2004.
Reputedly sent a letter to. Sorry.
Give the police, Paul. Give the guidance, okay?
Where he look. I'm very disappointed by the Sunni insurgents here. I want to deliberately provoke the Shia to attack Sunnis, so that more people will come within our ranks. And the Al Qaeda network started doing this within Iraq. And of course, in February 2006. Al-Qaeda targeted the Golden Mosque in Samarra, and that really took the civil war to a new level. So you really do see a correlation between a worsening civil war and an increase in tempo of attacks by Al-Qaeda. As the civil war progresses, Al-Qaeda within the country gets more and more lethal. It gains more and more Iraqi recruits. Now, some young Iraqis are now talking about a third of young Iraqis being their organization. Now, when asked, you know, whether that's because of the U.S. occupation or when asked, is it because of, you know, the Shia threatening Sunnis, it's the latter one which comes out as the explanation which is offered more. So it really is a sectarian conflict driving recruitment into Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, if you look at Iraq as a whole, and you look at what's happened in Anbar province in the last year. You've had a real success by the Americans in Anbar province in the last year, in the sense that attacks are down. Al Qaeda's been put on the back foot within the province. Tribal elements have sort of rebelled against Al Qaeda. But if you kind of examine that much more closely, you realize that it's because it's a very Sunni dominated part of the country that you've been able to have these inroads against Al Qaeda, because the local population is not living in fear of Shia death squads, therefore it's much easier for them to sort of turn away from Al Qaeda when Al Qaeda is sort of trying to impose their way of life on them, and so on and so forth. But in the central parts of Iraq, it's been very difficult to extend the Anbar model, because you've had this sectarian conflict, and because that is a recruiting tool for Al Qaeda within those areas of Iraq. So in this piece, Peter and I are arguing, Peter Bergen and myself are arguing, that the sectarian conflict is the main driver for Al-Qaeda recruitment. And that's not just for Iraqis joining Al-Qaeda in Iraq down the line. You know, suppose the United States withdraws its troops tomorrow from Iraq. That doesn't necessarily mean that foreign jihadists are going to stop coming to Iraq in significant numbers, because the regime which is presumably going to replace the U.S. occupation is a Shia dominated government, which will be seen as a proxy puppet to the United States. And for Sunni jihadists around the world, their two biggest enemies are sort of Shia and the United States. So they're likely to carry on coming to Iraq in significant numbers.
Well, I understand the scenario, but I still think that it's just a justification for continued occupation, and if stability needs to be put in by someone, and it does, why don't we authentically make an offer to really outfit an international peace force, including Muslim forces, but not neighboring Muslim forces?
Well, let me throw that back at you. You know, who's going to want to go into Iraq? Which international force exactly is that? You know, which countries are going to want to go in Iraq and fight? You know, if the United States is taking...
Well, I don't want them to go in and fight. Well, I want them to go in and stabilize the situation.
But, which country is going to be able to be willing to do that?
Well, if we spend some of the $2 trillion estimated over the next year or so, that'll be expended. If we spend some share of that that's coming up, the next tranche of money, on outfitting someone, it won't be one country. It'll have to be a multilateral force, and the UN has never been very good at that before, but given the logistics, it seems that it's the only possible solution.
Well, in the article, Peter Bergen and I are saying, it would be wrong to outsource U.S. national security to other countries.
Well, that's
Al-Qaeda in Iraq, if sort of left in Iraq, are probably going to become a greater threat. Certainly, other countries' soldiers are not going to be as effective as the United States in combating the group within the country. And I think that would be I think that's an illusion to believe that you can somehow pay other countries to go into Iraq and deal with a situation which was really the moral responsibility of the United States, not only of the United States administration, but by definition, the United States people, because last time I checked, the United States is a democracy. It elects administrations, and the U.S. administrations always do things in Americans' name. So collectively, the United States has a responsibility for what's going to happen in Iraq.
I'm going to jump in here. We have another caller getting lined up, and we're past our midpoint, and I would like to invite some others into the conversation here and also introduce again our guest, Paul Cruikshank. He is currently a fellow at the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. He's worked as an investigative journalist in London, reporting on al-Qaeda and its European affiliates. He was part of a CNN reporting team that covered the attacks in the summer of 2005 in London. He's also written about al-Qaeda and Islamist groups for a number of publications, including The New York Times, The Washington Post, The New Republic, and Mother Jones. In Mother Jones right now, there is an article that he co-authored with Peter Bergen on this very subject, al-Qaeda in Iraq. You can read it in the print edition. You can read it online at motherjones.com. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for a second, right at the very beginning, I asked you about numbers of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and you said that the estimates were something like 5,000 fighters and perhaps twice that many supporters, and noted that, and I'm sure most people would agree that that's not enough military force to take over Iraq. But if indeed the strategy really was, the deliberate strategy was to foment sectarian violence, Shia-Sunni violence, in what way is to that al-Qaeda's advantage? I mean, what ultimately do you think is the goal of al-Qaeda here?
Well, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who founded the al-Qaeda franchise in Iraq, deliberately fomented civil war within the country. He thought that by attacking Shias, that he would provoke the Shias to in turn attack Sunnis, and that therefore Sunnis would be awakened to want to fight, to want to resist the U.S. occupation, to want to resist the Shia-dominated government of the country. So it was a very deliberate strategy to provoke the Shia to attack the Sunni, to provoke the Sunni to become more militant and to join insurgent groups. And unfortunately, Zarqawi's strategy has been wildly successful. Exactly what he wanted happened, that al-Qaeda's spectacular suicide bombings of Shia mosques really made the Shia population very angry. That meant that they went after the Sunni, and you've had this vicious cycle of violence ever since, which has led to millions leaving the country, to tens of thousands being killed. So it's this chaos, this sectarian violence within Iraq, which is really driving Iraqis into the al-Qaeda organization. There were hardly any Iraqis in the al-Qaeda organization before 2003. It wasn't that they were suddenly all ideologically converted to al-Qaeda. It was that they were angry and they wanted retribution, or they wanted protection. And that's how they went into the al-Qaeda ranks within the country. Now, of course, once they're within the al-Qaeda ranks, then al-Qaeda can persuade them of their ideology, of the need to, attack the United States not only in Iraq but further afield. So now you've got a significant problem. You've got thousands of young Iraqis who are al-Qaeda fighters, who are al-Qaeda operatives, who have been trained in the art of terrorism and who are going to pose international security concerns going ahead. There are lots of refugees leaving the country. It's not very difficult for al-Qaeda in Iraq to take advantage of those refugee flows to smuggle fighters out of the country to conduct operations elsewhere. And we've already seen some evidence of this, which we quote in the piece. So those are some of the reasons I give.
Another caller here we'll talk with next, someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, what's the relationship between the al-Qaeda in Iraq and our reason for still being in Afghanistan? And I will hang up and listen to you online.
All right.
Well, There's a relationship between the Al Qaeda organization in Iraq and the Al Qaeda organization in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Essentially, and I use the word essentially with care, that they are all part of the same organization. Al Qaeda is certainly present in Afghanistan, particularly in the eastern part of the country. They're very present in the tribal areas of Pakistan and the western part of Pakistan, part of the country. Near the Afghan border. So Al Qaeda there are essentially two fronts against Al Qaeda right now. One is in Iraq, and the other is along the Afghan Pakistan border. So I think the United States is now having to fight Al Qaeda on these two fronts, and that is a really challenging proposition because Al Qaeda based in Pakistan certainly that's a real safe haven for them. They're able to train people for operations, against the West, against the United States, from there, pretty much with impunity. Iraq, they're fighting in significant numbers there, Iraq has also been a real sort of recruiting tool for jihadists around the world. It's been a cause célèbre, as the National Intelligence Estimate referred to it for jihadists. So. There are two fronts now, unfortunately, in the war on terrorism, and there didn't need to be two fronts. But the Bush administration decision to take resources away from Afghanistan, away from the South Asia area, and put them into Iraq really sort of helped Al-Qaeda strengthen themselves in the Afghan-Pakistan part of the world. But I think, the relationship between Afghanistan and Iraq and Pakistan right now is that Al-Qaeda are present in all places, and Al-Qaeda operatives in Pakistan and Afghanistan are taking advantage of Al-Qaeda in Iraq in order to get money from Iraq. Certainly, Al-Qaeda in Iraq is the biggest cash cow of the Al-Qaeda organization right now. It's raising millions of dollars from smuggling and kidnappings and other nefarious activities within the country. And some of that money is being channeled to operatives in Pakistan to plot operations against the West. So you have real synergies between Al-Qaeda's two fronts right now.
Are there significant numbers of Al-Qaeda operating anywhere else, if we set aside for a moment Iraq and Pakistan, Afghanistan? Are there other places where Al-Qaeda is active?
Those are the main two fronts. But Al-Qaeda and affiliates are active in other parts of the world. In the Arab world, you have a significant Al-Qaeda presence. For example, Algerian and Tunisian and Moroccan militants have now labeled themselves Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and they're launching a number of operations against governments, which they see as un-Islamic in those countries, but also against U.S. embassies and U.S. officials. You have a pretty significant Al-Qaeda organization in Saudi Arabia, which has also been responsible for a number of attacks over the last few years. Earlier this year, there was a plot where Al-Qaeda and Saudi Arabia were trying to assassinate members of the Saudi royal family. They were trying to take down oil installations, maybe even fly planes into them, and they were able to amass around $5 million, and some of those operatives in Al-Qaeda and Saudi Arabia have been trained in Iraq. So Al-Qaeda, do have a presence in other parts of the world. There have been Al-Qaeda plots in Europe. Most of those operatives were trained in Pakistan. Al-Qaeda affiliates also have a presence in Southeast Asia. Groups such as Jemaah al-Islamiyah and the Abu Sayyaf group have been active there. In Southeast Asia, though, Al-Qaeda affiliates are really a little bit on the run in recent times, but they've been strengthened elsewhere in the world. And one of the reasons they've been strengthened is because of the Iraq conflict. An article Peter Bergen and I did earlier this year in Mother Jones as well found there's been a 7 times increase in jihadist terrorism around the world since the war in Iraq. There's more terrorism because of the war in Iraq. It's been an inspiration to fighters around the world. It's been a recruiting tool for bin Laden. It's allowed training techniques that they've developed within Iraq, suicide bombing and IED attacks, to be sort of exported elsewhere. So Iraq has been a real boon to Al-Qaeda. That it doesn't follow, though, that withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq is suddenly going to make the problem go away. A lot of the damage by invading Iraq is already there. There's been a generation of young Muslims who've grown up with a paradigm. The United States is in the game of conducting a war against Islam. It's going to take a lot of time to sort of deprogram these individuals from that sort of point of view. And people who've learned terrorist techniques from Iraq, such as IED attacks, are not suddenly going to unlearn those techniques overnight. But if the U.S. forces do pull out of Iraq overnight, what will happen immediately is that al-Qaeda within Iraq will be strengthened. And that I think is probably something that the United States really must try and avoid, because the lesson from the 1990s is that if you leave a part of the world where al-Qaeda can operate more freely than other parts, then it's going to be able to plan operations, it's going to be able to down the line have the capability to launch plots not only in Europe, but potentially one day even in the United States.
Just to underline something that you have said, that in the time since September 11th, 2001, when the United States identified al-Qaeda and then perhaps also affiliated groups, groups that share the same agenda, these kinds of groups as being a major threat to American security, during all these years, when this has now been a priority for the United States, terrorism, the threat of terrorism, terrorist attacks have not been reduced, it would appear that the problem is much greater than it was in 2001.
That's
correct?
Right. Absolutely right. The Iraq War was something which basically the Iraq War has made the problem much worse than it might have been. You know, al-Qaeda was an organization on the ropes in 2002. Two-thirds of its leadership were captured or killed. There's a lot of dissension in the ranks. They feel that a lot of people felt that, you know, attacking the United States on 9/11 was a mistake because they'd lost their training camps in Afghanistan. Bin Laden himself was pretty depressed during this period from his writings. He wrote a will in late 2001, sort of almost throwing the towel in. But the Iraq War really for Bin Laden was like Christmas and Ramadan rolled into one. It meant that his slogan that the United States is at war with Islam was accepted by many, many more people than it was before. And we're seeing the consequence of this now. We're seeing more and more people being recruited into the al-Qaeda organization. And if you go to the sort of radical meetings in Europe, for example, which I've done, Iraq is used all the time. Iraq is their biggest propaganda weapon. And you see images of Abu Ghraib. You see images of American soldiers sort of going through neighborhoods within the country. And they use this for propaganda effect to say all Muslims in the world need to go to Iraq or contribute in some way towards the jihad in Iraq to remove the American presence from the country. So I certainly accept arguments that, you know, that Iraq has made the al-Qaeda threat worse. But what Peter Bergen and I are doing in this article is saying, well, yeah, that might well be the case, and we might be in a sort of catch-22 situation where we're damned if we pull out and we're damned if we stay in. But what we're arguing in this piece, with a very careful calculation, is that staying in is the better course of action, that the United States cannot afford to let parts of Iraq become a sanctuary for the al-Qaeda organization, because that would be even more dangerous than staying in. A lot of the damage from the Iraq War has already been done. You're not going to sort of deflate that extra jihadist energy by pulling out tomorrow. And certainly, you know, if you have the presence of a sort of, you know, when the U.S. troops pull out of the country, there's still going to be a sort of Shia-dominated government there, which is still going to be seen by jihadists as basically agents of the Americans. And that will still be used as a recruiting tool for people wanting to go into Iraq and for jihadists around the world. Certainly in Afghanistan, there were a number of Arab jihadists who went to Afghanistan before the Soviet Union was driven out in 1989. But most Arab jihadists went to Afghanistan after the Soviet Union left the country in 1989, because they wanted to join the bandwagon of something they saw as victorious, that they saw the jihadists as victorious against the two superpowers in the world at the time. So certainly U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, you know, is not going to suddenly make the problem go away. A lot of people wish it would, but it's not. And that's why what Peter Bergen and I here are trying to do is provoke people to try and think about what the exact consequences of pulling out from Iraq would be.
Yeah. We have about 5 minutes left. Our guest in this hour, Paul Cruickshank, he's an investigative journalist. He's written a lot about al-Qaeda and Islamist groups for a number of publications. And as we've mentioned in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine, he's co-authored a piece exploring this subject that we've been talking about. He's written this with Peter Bergens. You can read it in the print edition or you can read it online. I do want to see if we can get at least one more caller or two in the time that remains. And next we'll talk with someone in Tuscola on our line four. Hello.
Hello. I think you have some excellent points. It's unfortunate that we got ourselves in this quagmire in Iraq, and I predicted that this would recruit a tremendous amount of al-Qaeda people. One of the other things that is probably recruiting al-Qaeda is the fact that I was in Egypt, and I read a report that between 16 and 29, that the unemployment rate was somewhat like 80%. And a lot of highly educated people were taking menial jobs, and they were actually recruiting people to do labor jobs like plumbing and electricians after they graduated from college in different areas. And the thing I think that we have to center on, besides the fact that we have this problem with the occupation of Iraq and how this is recruiting, but the unemployment rate has got to be a major, major draw. If al-Qaeda can recruit people and pay them anything, they're probably interested in doing this. And I was just wondering what you think about this situation of that. I know it's quite prevalent in other Muslim countries, unemployment.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't think it's a question of, you know, al-Qaeda paying people, you know, to go to the country. I think that the people go from Arab countries into Iraq because they want to be part of a cause, they want to be part of the jihad, they feel it's legitimate, they feel they have an obligation to go and fight there. But if you do look at, you know, unemployment and general frustration, the population in countries in the Arab world, then I think that, you know, this is a contributing factor towards, you know, radicalism, towards Salafist types of religious interpretation, which are the sort of, for want of a better word, the sort of more hardline forms of interpretation. So, more radicalism because of frustration. Now, you know, the U.S. occupation of Iraq, of course, has turned that radicalism into some people wanting to go and kill American soldiers there, and some people wanting to join Bin Laden's network and launch attacks against Americans elsewhere in the world. Now, the al-Qaeda network clearly was in existence before the war in Iraq. 9/11 happened before the war in Iraq. That is absolutely the case. But Bin Laden now, because of the war in Iraq, has more potential recruits than ever before. And that's a real problem. Doesn't mean the United States is much less safe than it was at 9/11, because, you know, there have been a lot of improvements in terms of awareness of the threats, in terms of countermeasures, intelligence, alertness. Al-Qaeda has lost its sanctuary in Afghanistan, which was really, really somewhere where they did have this capability to conduct long-term planning. So al-Qaeda isn't necessarily a stronger organization in terms of its capability to attack the United States, but it's certainly one which has more recruits than ever before, and I think that's a real problem.
Hmm. Maybe we'll go real quick here to Urbana for another caller, line two. Hello.
Yes, I'm interested. How gradual is your gradual in regard to withdrawal?
Well, I mean, the Defense Secretary Robert Gates has suggested that long term, and there should be around 30,000 U.S. troops sort of stationed within Iraq.
How many mercenaries he's going to hire if he only has 30,000 troops?
Well, I mean, that is...
The British were there 20 years, and they never were able to reduce their troop concentration. They finally withdrew because they had to. The Second World War.
I think that, you know, there's a real debate that needs to be had about how many troops you keep in and for how long. Certainly, a number of scholars have suggested that if you bring the troops down to too low a level, they become ineffective because all they're doing is really protecting themselves within the country. But I think a figure in the sort of high tens of thousands for the next 5 years is something which a lot of people are kind of coming around to. So, you know, 5 years, you know, more of having, say, 70, 80, 90,000 troops within the country, not these, you know, high 130,000, 160,000 numbers you're seeing now, but enough really to keep a lid on this civil war, to give these political leaders in Iraq more space to come up with some sort of agreement. And one of the dynamics you're seeing right now is sort of interesting because the United States decided to basically strengthen Sunnis within the country, that they're giving a lot of money and weapons to Sunni tribal elements, not only to fight al-Qaeda, but also sort of to establish control in their areas of influence within the country. Now, the strengthening of the Sunni community compared to the Shia community could be very dangerous, you know, because it could really, but it could also be an opportunity for the Shia leaders to come to some sort of agreement with their Sunni counterparts, because if there's more of a sort of equality in forces, you might have more breathing space for some sort of arrangement. Of course, you know, everything we've seen in Iraq has gone in the wrong direction of recent times, but I think that there is some optimism there, perhaps, that if U.S. troops can stay in and keep a lid on the civil war for, you know, in the next 5 years, and that there's some agreement, move towards agreement might be possible.
We're going to have to stop at this point because we've really come to the end of the time, with, of course, the promise that I'm sure on other days we will be returning to the subject with other guests, so we'll give you the opportunity to hear a variety of viewpoints. For the moment, though, we're going to have to close. I do want to mention again that our guest, Paul Cruikshank, has co-authored an article with Peter Bergen that appears in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. You can read it online at motherjones.com, or you can go and look at the print edition. Paul is currently fellow at the Center on Law and Security at New York University's School of Law. He's worked as investigative journalist in London. He reported on al-Qaeda and its European affiliates there. He was part of a CNN team that covered the attacks in July of 2007 in London. He's also contributed to other publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the New Republic.